Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu, and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Bors. So it's the start of term again, and Boris Johnson this morning is chairing his first cabinet back. James, what's on the agenda?
So Sajid Javid is going to present to cabinet today on the kind of plans to level up the country, so essentially to close the north-south gap. That's obviously going to be one of the big focuses of the budget, which is going to be on March the 11th. So I think what is interesting about this is there's been a lot of speculation about whether Sajid Javid will keep his job or not. I think he is pretty safe. You know, Boris Johnson said during the campaign that Sajid Javid would continue as Chancellor. And I think what is interesting about this is the Treasury leaning into the fight. The Treasury essentially saying, look, you don't need to create another economics department, Prime Minister, because we are here. We are going to do this stuff about, you know, changing the rules in the Green Book to ensure that there's more capital spending happens outside London and the South East, something that Boris Johnson outlined to us in an interview with Katie and me during the campaign trail. Is that the right grammar? If you carry on, I think what you see here is, you know, this is going to be one of the big focuses of this government. You know, can it actually succeed in dealing with two persistent British problems? One is the North-South divide. And secondly, the other is the productivity issue. You know, what is Britain's biggest economic problem by a country mile? It's low levels of productivity. Can this government, through infrastructure, through skills, through research in science and technology, can it find a way to address that problem in 5 years' time, or 4 years' time? Whether the government is making progress on that question will be the most important issue.
Katie, James mentioned there just now the Treasury leaning into this sort of idea of civil service reform. But today we're hearing that civil service reform might not be as wide-ranging as Dominic Cummings might like.
So there's been lots of talk about the government shake-up and the various plans and part of that civil service. And a big aspect is clearly Whitehall, and civil service feeds into it. Part of what was discussed over Christmas and the report, there are many discussions about shaking up the various departments. So the idea, as we discussed in this podcast, was mooted of taking immigration out of the Home Office. But there are now reports, there's one specific one in the Daily Mail suggesting that it's not going to be such a drastic redrawing of Whitehall departments as people were expecting. So you have a situation where, when it comes to things like immigration in the Home Office and also, for example, DFID, the Department for International Development, it might now stay. Now, I understand there will still be, when it comes to February, when there's going to be a cabinet reshuffle and the Whitehall departments will become clearer, there is still going to be some departmental changes. I don't think all the departments we see now are going to be there in the same form as we currently see them. But I think that what is true is that ultimately it's not going to be, you know, this a smashing ball through Whitehall, as some have been suggesting. And I think that clearly then feeds into, in terms of civil service who staff these departments, and Dominic Cummings' blog, which we had just to kick off the new year, in which they talked about new skills and so forth. I mean, I think recruitment is going to be one really big issue for this government, which is they say they want to change the skill level that civil servants have coming in. But I think finding the right people is going to be quite an uphill task, particularly in the numbers they potentially need them to bring about all the changes they want.
I think one of the other things is Brexit acts as a kind of constraint on what the government can do here. Because, you know, for example, there is a fairly strong intellectual case to make for creating a new borders department, you know, that would handle immigration, customs, all of that. But do you really want to be doing that at the same time as preparing for December 2020, when the UK leaves the single market and the customs union? So I think there is a sense of kind of, let's get Brexit done on in the government.
I thought it had been done because the Conservative government had been elected.
And then address some of these Whitehall machinery of government issues. I think also Katie hits the nail on the head there. It is where I don't think we're going to see any undermining of radicalism is in terms of trying to change how the civil service works. I mean, I don't think any final decisions have been taken, but I'm told that Boris Johnson has come back from his Caribbean holiday with a kind of slight view that kind of, you know, that the danger of machinery of government changes is that they end up becoming the story. They end up becoming the thing that you do, and your reforming energy gets taken up by that rather than actual reforms. But I think the aim to change how the civil service works and operates and delivers on policy, I don't think any of that is changing, because, you know, I think both Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings have a view that, you know, unless you change that, you're not going to get better results on all those things like the North-South gap, productivity, etc., etc., etc.
And also, I don't think it's just civil servants. Another thing, everyone focused on civil servants when they read that blog post by Boris Johnson's senior aide, but it clearly also referred to special advisers. Mm. Now, perhaps this is a beltway topic. I don't think most people spend that much time thinking about special advisers. Some people think of them as glorified bag carriers. But if you think about, I suppose, the people who are closest to their Secretary of State, they work closely with ministers, it does seem that even there, there's also a skill set change that they want, you know, more focused, specific knowledge, and move away from, I suppose, who you know and who can work Westminster in the most effective way.
Although I think every Secretary of State will always want someone who can work Westminster in a very effective way.
Just number 10 might not.
I think there is obviously a Westminster selection bias issue. You know, look, we in some ways, around this table, we typify the problem. You know, three of us, three arts graduates, you know, not a scientist or a mathematician between us.
I would like to say, though, to be honest, I had to do compulsory logic as part of my philosophy degree.
Snap that. I also had economics, which has some maths.
Yep, so James, just because history didn't include that doesn't mean you have to try and bring us down with you.
And I think that is... I mean, that's an interesting challenge, but I think in reality, one of the other issues that's going to have to get addressed here, which is not a particularly popular thing to say, is the question of civil service pay. If you want to go around hiring people with maths degrees, science degrees, they can generally command higher starting salaries coming straight out of university. The civil service is going to have to become more competitive on pay. I mean, there is a big question here, which is, you know, do you want ultimately a smaller civil service that is better paid, or do you want to keep the civil service at the same size? I mean, there's going to be one of the big contentions in the coming years.
But James, if those wide-ranging reforms are going to be waiting until transition is over, I mean, doesn't Dominic Cummings want to be phasing himself out of the government? That's what he said in his blog post, that within a year's time he hopes that he'll not be so central to the operation, so he won't be around for those reforms.
That's not how I read that blog post.
Okay.
I read that blog post as he doesn't want to be working. He doesn't want to be in a situation where, you know, he is doing kind of 18-hour days in 12 months' time, 2 years' time. He kind of wants to kind of have a kind of more balanced situation. And I mean, but I also think this is a question which is, again, so we come to Brexit here. And I think this is, I think one of the big misreadings of the last few months is, one of the big misreadings of this new decade, let's say, is this idea that the size of the majority means that Brexit is going to become softer. You know, lots of people in the city think this. They think, oh, look, you know, Boris Johnson is no longer beholden to a small number of his backbenchers, and so that means he's going to end up going for a softer Brexit than we expect. I mean, that is a profound misreading of a situation. I think it's worth remembering that, you know, Boris Johnson resigned from the government over Chequers, which was all about, you know, continuing to align with the EU on goods and agriculture. You know, I think the principle of divergence is hugely important to Boris Johnson, and that leads you to a kind of very different type of Brexit. I'm not saying that means you're going to start diverging on the morning of January the 1st, 2021, but I do not think that he is going to be, when he sees Ursula von der Leyen for the, you know, for the first time in her role as Commission President, I think he is going to be quite clear with her on Wednesday night that he is not interested in kind of, you know, a relationship that is about preserving as much as possible from the past. I think he is much more about, you know, he is going to want a free trade agreement that allows the UK to diverge from EU rules. Now, I think this is going to be, I think there is a potential here for quite a blow up, because the EU keeps saying, well, you can get your deal by December 2020, but that involves you basically agreeing to a level playing field and alignment. He is not interested in doing those things. So I think that is going to become one of the big stories of this year, which is this clash between a UK government that now doesn't have to worry about Parliament binding its hands, but is quite determined to pursue this course, and an EU that thinks that this is going to be a bit like phase one, where the UK will be forced to accept this because of the time pressure that December 2020 deadline exerts.
So if he's faced with the option of no deal at the end of 2020, a soft Brexit or an extension, what do you think he would go for?
In number 10's view, there is no such thing as no deal at the end of 2020. There'd be no trade deal, but it's not no deal because, and I think this is an important point because, you know, what ultimately put Theresa May off no deal, I think more than anything else, was the Irish border question. You know, that I think she just simply balked at the idea of the fact that there would have to be some kind of border construction on the island of Ireland and what that would mean for the peace process, etc., etc. That question is now dealt with. The second most emotive question, which is, you know, what would happen to the 3 million EU citizens living here? What would happen to the UK citizens living in the EU? That is also dealt with. I also think that because there is an agreement on the money, this is not going to be the kind of acrimonious no deal where the EU decides to stop every single British lorry at Calais or refuses kind of cabotage agreements, all that stuff. So we're not in there. And I think one of the other things that's worth noting is that, you know, if the UK ended up going for a Canada-style free trade deal with the EU, in terms of a level of friction at the border, that is not that dramatically different from a WTO Brexit. You know, the important point is that what Chequers was an attempt to kind of leave the single market but half stay in it and to more than half stay in the customs union. This government wants to leave both the single market and the customs union, and that means that, you know, a certain amount of friction at the borders is just a logical consequence of that.
Yeah, there are, one thing I think to look out for is ultimately if you're leaving with the option of diverging when you actually choose to, means that it might not be a drastic change straight away. So you can agree a deal where if you diverge things change, but and the UK can say, well, we can diverge, we just haven't diverged yet, hence why everything, you know, is running as you perhaps would have thought it would, you know, a month ago when we didn't have that option. So I think although we are heading to that type of Brexit, it still has scope for to not to be what people would call a cliff edge, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I mean, they are very keen. I mean, the important thing, I think, for number 10 is that in January 2021, free movement has ended and the supremacy of the European Court of Justice has ended. And I think, as Katie says, you know, that doesn't mean that they're going to suddenly on the 1st of January 2021 announce that we're coming up with our own UK standards for car engines, it's, you know, widget sizes, all that stuff. But I think it means that they want to have the potential to have their own standards on those things. I mean, that is hugely important to them.
And over on Labour land, Rebecca Long-Bailey has formally announced her leadership bid. How's that going for her?
Well, she's finally launched officially. She put out an article late last night on the Tribune magazine website. For those of our listeners who don't regularly read the Tribune, I think it's safe to say that it is on the left. And I think it is telling that she decided to publish her piece there. She'd previously published a piece in The Guardian, I think, with mixed results, would put it kindly, where she spoke about progressive patriotism, which she managed to do the strange thing of drawing criticism from those perhaps on the centre-right who don't like Rebecca Long-Bailey anyway, in terms of centre-right in the Labour Party, so I do mitigate it slightly, but also Corbyn supporters who didn't like the idea of patriotism being used and questioned actually what this even meant and if it was pointing to a form of nationalism. I think this piece, it's fair to say, has landed a lot better. Mm-hmm. And in it, Rebecca Long-Bailey is really putting forward her credentials to be the continuity Corbyn candidate and to be the unashamedly continuity Corbyn candidate. We saw Keir Starmer in his video often trying to almost hug Jeremy Corbyn close. In fact, he was actually physically hugging Jeremy Corbyn too in some of the clips. But Rebecca Long-Bailey goes further. She's talking about the fact that she completely stands by a lot of what was in the Labour manifesto. She talks about the Labour's Green New Deal. She says they should have pressed more. She said, I don't just support these policies, I helped write them. So you can see her taking ownership of the past project and not saying, I wrote them and I need to think about that because we ultimately lost and the Tories have quite a large majority, but actually saying this is what we need to press on with. Now, in terms of what she says has gone wrong. She thinks that, I think, is put down more to narrative than anything specifically wrong with the package. Again, Brexit isn't a heavy topic in it. And actually, in terms of people who receive criticism, I would say it's Labour leaders and the Labour Party of the past pre-Corbyn, rather than Jeremy Corbyn. She talks, for example, about how the Labour Party has clearly made mistakes in the past, and this is the fact that they were too close to Rupert Murdoch at times, and that's not referring to the Jeremy Corbyn era, just in case anyone needs me to point that out. Also the fact that during the EU referendum, there were some Labour politicians and the Labour Party willing to work closely with David Cameron. I think by that, working on the same Remain campaign as David Cameron, and suggests that could be an issue. I think if you're going to look at anything which is critical of the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn, she says there was too much of a focus on parliamentary wrangling over the past couple of years. She's talking about how there should be a revolution in many ways, and actually what they need to do is declare war on the establishment if she was leader. How is it landing? I think war is a good sign for her. I'm not suggesting Ian Lavery was going on to win the Labour leadership, but Ian Lavery was tipped to potentially put his hat in. He said he's not going to do that. He's supporting Rebecca Long-Bailey. And I think it was a worrying sign for Rebecca Long-Bailey when Ian Lavery started suggesting he was seriously considering thinking about it, because ultimately it was a sign that some on the left of the Labour Party, traditional Corbyn supporters, were having doubts about Rebecca Long-Bailey's suitability. There was a sense that she hadn't got her campaign organised. People were asking why it was taking so long. I think that nerves have been calmed with the release of this. Tonight we're going to have the first hustings with the various candidates, so we'll see what she has to deliver there. But ultimately, the first YouGov poll of the Labour membership suggests Keir Starmer is on course to comfortably win, but Rebecca Long-Bailey I don't think can be underestimated in this, not in terms particularly of whether her package has a wide appeal to the country at large, but in terms of the Labour Party, she has some big backers. It's likely she will have the support of several of the big unions, but it's yet to be confirmed. Momentum could well back her. Nothing is confirmed yet, but if Momentum back her, one of the worries of the rival leadership teams is that this means that she could get access to important data. And as the rules currently state, when it comes to Labour membership data and information like that, you don't get it till you're past the first two rounds, just in case people want to know the rough timetable. Ultimately, we all know the leader by early April. We have a situation where the first round is the parliamentary round where you need, I read 21, 22 MPs in different places. I was told it was 21, but it's around that percentage level to back you. And then candidates will then have a month, if they can get past through that first stage, to get the support of a number of CLPs, so constituency parties, or free affiliates. So, and they have to win a minimum of two trade unions. There was talk that there'd be a stitch-up, and that's what some contenders are really worried about in terms of the NEC meeting we talked about yesterday. But I think broadly speaking, despite some concerns about access to data, it doesn't feel as though that has happened. And actually, by breaking up in terms of rounds, the parliamentary stage round, and winning the support of affiliates and CLPs, that helps candidates who aren't Rebecca Long-Bailey and Keir Starmer, who are the two front runners, because it means that if you're a candidate at least in Nandi, you can focus right now on working on MPs on the next week, and then you have an entire month to work out. And because we expect a couple of candidates to get knocked out in the parliamentary stages, it's going to be easier for those, I suppose, second-tier candidates, because there'll be fewer of them, to get to the number of nominations they need from unions and CLP, rather than all competing. I think there was a risk if they were doing it all at once, they would cancel each other out, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and the chips do seem to be falling in place for Rebecca Long-Bailey, because Angela Rayner had been, there were rumours that she might not support her as deputy leader, but last night she came out to say that she would. James, do you think Rebecca Long-Bailey is a sort of Labour leader that the Tories would fear?
No, but I also think that this current Labour leadership field, you know, is not one that particularly scares the Tory party. I mean, I think if you think about it, you know, Rebecca Long-Bailey is offering herself as continuity Corbyn, essentially. Corbynism without Corbyn, right? I'm not sure what that's.
I heard Corbynism with a smile.
Okay.
She's smiley.
Which I'm not sure is something that particularly is going to worry the Tory party. She is also clearly going to take some pot shots at Keir Starmer. You know, when she talks about a war on the establishment, you wonder whether she means Sir Keir Starmer, the former director of public prosecutions. And then you've got Keir Starmer, who, again, you know, is, I live in North London, there's nothing wrong with North London, but he is another North London MP to follow Jeremy Corbyn. And it's if one of the reasons why Labour lost so many of its heartlands was its parliamentary gamesmanship on Brexit, which I think is one of the things that did hurt it. You know, Keir Starmer was the architect of that strategy. And then you've got Keir Starmer, who, again, you know, is, I live in North London, there's nothing wrong with North London, but he is another North London MP to follow Jeremy Corbyn. And it's hard, it is, again, you know, if one of the reasons why Labour lost so many of its heartlands was its parliamentary gamesmanship on Brexit, which I think is one of the things that did hurt it. You know, Keir Starmer was the architect of that strategy. Making him leader, is that the kind of right way to win back those leave voting places that the Labour Party lost at this election? I mean, that's a dubious question. I think Jess Phillips is the high risk, high reward strategy for Labour. She obviously has a way of connecting with the public, a memorable turn of phrase. But I think, as you also saw on Andrew Marr, the level of scrutiny you get as a leadership candidate compared to a backbench MP is very different. And she walked into that whole question of rejoining the EU, which she then tried to walk back from. You know, Lisa Nandy, you can see how she represents a kind of appeal to kind of small town, but she is remarkably kind of untested and unknown by the public, you know. And so I don't think this is a field that does kind of schedule. I don't think Dan Jarvis could win, but I think if you were looking at someone who would worry number 10, it would be someone like him, because he would instantly deal with Labour's values issues, you know. And, you know, he is a Barnsley MP, he is the mayor of the Sheffield metro region, you know, he's a former soldier, and he's got a kind of compelling personal story about it, as different from Jeremy Corbyn as you could be. But he would struggle to get out past the parliamentary rounds, and as Katie said, he would struggle to meet all those criteria of round one that I think are slightly more stringent than some people have realised.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a single candidate that strikes fear into the heart of everyone in number 10. I think it's very hard to predict, though, exactly the terms. For example, if Brexit feels that it's more of a closed issue, perhaps it wouldn't be such a problem for someone like Keir Starmer. If the Brexit debate is still waging on, I think that's more active and it's more difficult for him. Labour wants to draw a line behind it. But it is worth remembering, I mean, clearly we've just had a disastrous Labour result, but no one thought Jeremy Corbyn would have any impact when he was picked as Labour leader. Ultimately, he was the Downing Street at the Times preferred choice in many sense. I mean, some people think you want a strong opposition, but they didn't think he'd be a strong opposition. And yes, he never won power, but he definitely gave Downing Street some sleepless nights. And at one point, did seem to be getting quite close to it. So I think it is hard to predict how exactly this is going to play out, because there's just so many variables over the next couple of years.
Good hedging your bets, Katie. Katie and James, thanks very much. And if you like this podcast, please tell your family and friends about it. And also, why not check out more podcasts from The Spectator if you go on Spectator Radio, which is a selection of some of our best podcasts. So just search Spectator Radio on wherever you get your podcasts from. Thanks for listening, and join us again later today.